All right. Hello, hello. August 29th, 2023. I am in North Carolina, Southern Dharma Retreat Center. This Tuesday, retreat starts tonight. So I will not be teaching on Friday night. So one of our wonderful substitute friends, I think probably Debbie this week. We shall see, but there will be a class on Friday. And then next Tuesday, where am I going to be? I don't know. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's just be here now. So we'll start with a 20-minute meditation period, and I'll give some instruction and then give you some quiet time. Well, starting just by establishing your posture, this key element of meditation that grounds us in our body, helps us to establish a balance of energy. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And turning the attention inward first to the feeling of just sitting still. Our lives tend to be so active that just to come into physical stillness can kind of be a striking experience almost. Helps you to wake up right there. And within that stillness, we can also detect the movement of breath, the movement of the heart, the energy of the nervous system. And having a sense of releasing tension in through the body, if you feel any tension, softening the belly, loosening the jaw, releasing the shoulders, a sense of settling. And even the feeling of connecting with the effects of gravity, just feeling how the body is being drawn to the earth, that weight. There's just this sense of letting go, just for these few minutes. And as you incline toward that surrender, you might also be aware of it. Resistance or limits, the ways that your body still holds on to some subtle tension. We're not trying to force anything, just to be mindful. How much can you let go and how much still lingers? that subtle underlying tension. Not judging or resisting that, just connecting with the breath. Here you are, sitting and breathing. The feelings are what they are. Pleasant or unpleasant or more neutral. Such a tendency we have to try to create a feeling or to control how we feel. The challenge of mindfulness is to allow whatever is arising to be there without trying to impose our own preferences. And so you can connect with the sensations of breath. Breath at the nostrils or the movement in the belly. Just letting that natural rhythm settle and focus the mind. Bringing an attitude of kindness, gentleness to this process. No demands, no requirements. Being with things as they are. Acting to the present moment through the experience of breathing. All right. Oh, nice to sit together as much as we can say that we are together. I have been reading one of Ajahn Amaro's books called Catastrophe Apostrophe, which that's just a funny title. And I actually first heard him talking about it. I think he was, I'm not sure if he was reading from it or referencing it, but if you're interested, Ajahn Amaro, who is an English Buddhist monk in the Thai forest tradition. He is the abbot of the Amaravati Monastery in England. And their website, which is amaravati.org, has books that you can just download for free. So I downloaded this one. It's on my Kindle. So I'm just going to read some of this. And this section is it's on the three characteristics, which are impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. He says about the three characteristics. He says all patterns of experience are understood to possess these three qualities of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. By using these three as tools to explore our attitudes, presumptions, attachments, and conditioning, we can discover where the mind habitually looks in vain for permanence, certainty, happiness, and the real me. Insight meditation, vipassana, is the process of that revelation and the freedom of heart that results from it. So then he takes each of these in turn, starting with impermanence, which in Pali is anicca. This means the quality of change, transitoriness in the objective domain, and the quality of uncertainty on the subjective side of things, which that very definition is quite interesting. I want to just talk a little bit about this. So he's saying that on an objective level, impermanence just means everything is changing all the time. And that's how we usually understand it. That's usually how we talk about impermanence. But then he says, on the subjective side, so our own experience of it is this quality of uncertainty, which he says, when the heart experiences change in the field of perception, it does not know what that object will change into. Thus, it feels uncertainty. So, we can see how, like, that's how impermanence, we know how impermanence causes us anxiety because we're uncertain about things. We don't know how things are going to, it's one thing to say, oh, everything is always changing, but then it's like, yeah, but what's it going to change into, right? This is our kind of underlying fear that we all have, why we don't like change. So the other thing that I want to add, which is interesting, which is that Ajahn Pasano, who was like Ajahn Amaro's like buddy, like they were co-abbots at one time of a monastery, Ajahn Pasano often quotes Ajahn Chah, the famous Thai master who was their both of their teachers and kind of the inspiration for their whole tradition. Ajahn Chah instead of talking about impermanence, apparently talked about uncertainty. So he would just say, it's uncertain, which is, and that the Thai language is mine, and I'm going to type that, so mine. So you often hear Ajahn Pasano going like, mine, it's uncertain. And I like those little catchphrases, right? They help us to have these little things that are like triggers for us to remember. It's uncertain. And that also really brings to mind the teachings of the Korean Zen master Sansa Nim, whose teaching was, don't know. And that's how he would say it. He would teach meditation. He would say, breathing in, clear mind, clear mind. Breathing out, don't know. And so don't know is uncertainty, right? So it's like, just as I say, I like these little phrases that can like come to mind when things are like spinning out of control, and I can just be like, oh, it's uncertain, I don't know, it's impermanent, So I'm going to read a little bit more from Ajahn Amaro, since I've so far only read about a paragraph. When meditation is well developed, the attention becomes more steady and is able to rest easily in the present moment. From this point of rest, we can use those three characteristics as reflections to examine the very nature of experience, to see how the mind works. In order to develop this perspective during meditation, we let the breath, the feelings of the body, the sounds we hear around us, the sensations in our feet as we walk, we let them be part of a continuous flow of experience. Let them merely be patterns of perception that arise and pass away and sustain the quality of open awareness, being attentive to patterns of change, the perception as they arise and pass away in each moment. There is a conscious letting go of interest in the content of experience in order to fully appreciate the process of experiencing. So that's the last sentence of that paragraph, and he's leading to that. So this is like the critical idea that he's getting at. The conscious letting go of interest in the content of experience in order to fully appreciate the process of experiencing. So this is what I call viewing experience through the lens of Dharma rather than through the lens of self. Our ordinary way of behaving in the world and, natural way of being is like, it's about me and I'm dealing with the world and I have to, this is coming at me and how am I going to respond to that? And this is coming up inside me. This is how I'm going to act. That's fine. That's how we function in the world. But the Buddha and the Dharma are pointing to this other way of being, right? Which we're all trying to get to. That's why we come to these groups and why we practice, right? Is to get a little space from self, from our self-centeredness and our self-obsession and all the things that leads to all the agitation and, the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness, the suffering that arises through that. And this is helpful because what Ajahn Amaro is helpful, what he is saying is helpful, I think, because you can meditate regularly, but at times you might kind of stop and go, why am I doing this? And what is the point of this? Like, I know for myself, it's something that I got into just very sort of habitually. And I began with a lot of magical ideas about it. And then eventually it was like, well, that's not what's happening. I'm not having an enlightenment. I'm not levitating. It's like, what is going on? And so this idea that or trying to become interested in the process of experience rather than the content. And this really points to what we do when we're meditating, right? What happens when you're meditating? Like, what are we taught to do? Okay, I'm trying to pay attention to the breath, and then my mind wanders. And at that point, I realize that I have been interested in the content, right, of my mind. But because I'm meditating, I've learned, oh, what I'm going to do is I'm going to let go of that content. But part of that letting go is seeing the process. So I'm seeing, first of all, that, oh, I mean, there's many things that you can see in that. But first of all, I might just see, oh, I'm trying to pay attention to my breath, but my mind wants to do something else. So the first thing you realize is I'm not really in control of my mind. Okay, so that's part of the process that I'm seeing. Oh, okay, that's interesting because that's an insight. Because the ordinary way of thinking about ourselves is like, this is my mind and I'm thinking my thoughts and I have some control over it. And to realize, oh, like I'm trying to direct my mind to do something it won't do. So, okay, I'm not in control of it. And then I might also see that, oh, those thoughts are just constantly flowing, like that they're impermanent. Oh, my thoughts aren't solid things. I might also realize my thoughts aren't even facts. They're not true. They're just ideas. What are they? Well, they're just words and images that appear in the mind. Okay. And then I might also see that those thoughts are stirring up feelings in me. And that for me is like the critical thing. It's seeing the process by which suffering arises. And so rather than thinking, oh, my problem is the thing that I'm thinking about, I have to solve this problem that I think I have, I realize it's the thinking about it that's actually causing me pain. Doesn't mean I shouldn't think about it or that there aren't things that I shouldn't deal with in life, but just to see like so much of what's going on that seems to be that is agitating is just being created in my own mind. So all of this is right, the insight that we're trying to get at. And so with mindfulness, we're always trying to step, it's very interesting. The paradox of mindfulness and of meditation is that in some sense we're stepping back to view process in this way, like, oh, I'm not identifying, I'm stepping away from self, and I'm just looking at this as a process. But in another sense, I'm getting closer, right? Because I'm becoming very sensitive to the breath and I'm being very sensitive to my felt experience. So this is to me one of the kind of interesting paradoxes of our meditation, that there's a moving closer and a moving further away that are kind of happening at the same time. So this is a, I think a valuable thing to remember for ourselves, that what I'm trying to do is view the process of my experience instead of the content of my experience. And that means, again, going back to the three characteristics, that I'm trying to see the impermanent nature of things, that they're constantly changing, so I can't hold on to them and I can't control them. The unsatisfactory nature of things, that no matter what happens, I'm never going to arrive at total satisfaction and resolution. So I striving after that is just going to be frustrating. So I can let go of that. And then finally, the not self nature of it, that it's that w even the self that I think is operating here is actually just an illusion created by the interaction of mind and body. I won't go too far with that today. It's another topic, as you guys know. So now I want to read the last paragraph in this section. He says, in this way of developing the practice of meditation, the heart is embodying that quality of wakeful awareness. Essentially, it is being Buddha, being awake. And what that wakeful awareness knows is the Dhamma, that is to say, the patterns of nature as they arise and pass away. When the Buddha sees the Dhamma, what arises is the Sangha. When the awake mind sees the way things are, what arises is harmonious action, the inclination of the heart toward what is noble and wholesome. So this is actually how Ajahn Amaro, and I think Ajahn Chah as well, characterizes the three refuges that I think you guys are probably all familiar with. The refuge, I take refuge in the Buddha, take refuge in the Dharma, take refuge in the Sangha. So what the, instead of thinking of the Buddha as this historical figure or the great teacher, here it's the Buddha refers to the quality of being awake, of, and in even more simplistic terms, of being mindful. So when we say we're taking refuge in that, what we're saying is that we are striving to be awake. We're saying that being awake is how I want to live. And that's a big statement, because certainly as addicts, we know that our goal was not to be awake. It was in some sense to be asleep or to be detached or be shut down or to be other than we are. But even in the larger culture, we understand that mindfulness and being awake to the truth, to reality, to being present, is not something most people are striving for. I mean, they might say they are, but when you look at how most people live and do, including, I mean, all of us, you know, how many of us, of course, we're not, you know, every moment trying to be mindful, most of us, you know, there are certain times of day when I just go, okay, time to shut down. Like, I don't have the mental or physical energy to, like, okay, be really mindful. So then I go to some entertainment, right? Fine. You know, not judging that, but seeing, okay, like, this is my intention, is to be awake. And so then when we are awake in this characterization of this, what we're awake to is the truth of the way things are, which is typically how the Thai forest monks characterize it. The truth of the way things are. And the truth of the way things are is that they are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. So it's, you know, we see this always like cycles back, right? And then this is interesting, because so that's the Dharma, right? And so typically when we talk about taking refuge in the Dharma, we're talking about like maybe putting it in more general or broader terms, the teachings of the Buddha. But here it's pointing more specifically to the three characteristics. Either way, it's what is true, you know, and being devoted to that, not being devoted to delusion, you know, to living in delusion. And you know, and that's challenging, because the truth of the way things are is not always easy to be with, to accept. And I'll say that there's kind of a balance. If we're saying the Buddha is being awake, part of that wakeful nature is compassionate. And it understands, so that when we are awake, that can help us to hold the truth of the way things are. We learn how to hold that, because, you know, when we're not sort of stable in some sense and kind of present, and we get hit with some painful reality, some painful truth, it can be really hard to hold. And this is why the part of, you know, becoming a Buddha, if you will, and cultivating our Buddhahood is building up the strength of heart to be able to hold it. It's not just, oh, I'm open and loving. It's also that there's a strength in here to be able to hold the truth, to be able to accept that, yes, I'm aging and I will die. And yes, My children will age and die, and this world we live in, there is great suffering in this world, and how am I going to respond to that? Because if I get overwhelmed by that, then I can't do anything useful or gain any value from this life. So I have to develop the strength of heart to hold the truth. And so then it's interesting too that, as Amaro says here, when the Buddha sees the Dhamma, when the wakeful mind sees the truth of the way things are, what arises at the Sangha, and that what arises is harmonious action, the inclination of the heart toward what is noble and wholesome. Because typically we say, oh, the Sangha refers to the community, right? The Buddhist community. And strictly speaking and literally speaking, that's true. But on this metaphorical level and on this really in a more underlying sense, that the Sangha is just this expression of wisdom and compassion that arises through this process. And it's a beautiful way of thinking about each of us containing the refuges, rather than, oh, I have this, I can be wakeful and I can see the Dhamma, but in order to have Sangha, I have to get together with other people. I mean, of course, that's valuable and important and vital, but to also see that how I'm living is an expression of Sangha. It's that my own wisdom or insight has manifests in this skillful way. And this is right in harmony with recovery, because recovery is very much an expression of the, harmonious action, right? It's trying to live in a more harmonious way in the world. So, in some sense, we could say that the recovery process goes in reverse from Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. It starts with Sangha, because it starts with community, right? Going to a meeting. And it starts with this understanding that I need to live differently. I need to express my life. I need to just act differently and live differently. And then through that, we start to gain more wisdom and hopefully awaken. Spiritual awakening is the 12th step, right? Whereas Ajahn Amaro, in a way, is implying that we start with this wakeful mind. And of course, it's not, neither of these is a linear process. It's all intertwined. But, interesting to sort of see it that way, to see that this expression of community through harmonious action is the beginning point of recovery. So I love, I mean, obviously Ajahn Amaro has been a really important teacher for me, and he's somebody who actually, when I was writing One Breath at a Time, he read the manuscript of that book and gave me notes on it. So my relationship with him goes way back. But he's always had a way of his voice, and his way of teaching has always really resonated for me, and I continue to really resonate with him. One of the few teachers I haven't felt like, okay, that's good, I had enough, which is a natural part of our process, but in any case, I also really enjoy just finding a short passage like that, and encourage you as well. I'm sure you guys know this, but just if you haven't thought about it, to take short passages of teachings and let them become a reflection, because this is something I read a few days ago, and I've been kind of going back to it repeatedly, and I intend to actually use it maybe tonight as in the opening of our retreat. There's just to find these kind of pure, simple, direct teachings that can be really rich. So thank you for your attention, and hope that was helpful. And we have a few minutes left for anybody who wants to chime in or share anything or ask any questions. I see Jonathan, hello.
Hey Kevin, I have a like off topic question, but I was hoping I could ask it anyways. It's about Satipatthana's like third and fourth, and like where like the reflect like I guess does like contemplation of impermanence fit into either of those levels of Satipatthana? And I guess like where specifically, because now I'm like starting to second guess. I'm like, well, I guess it fits into like Vedana as well, because like we're noticing impermanence of like the feeling tones. But is
Right.
there like a does it fit somewhere kind of more, I guess?
Well, actually, every one of the four, so Jonathan is talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the Satipatthana Sutta in Pali, which is kind of a core meditation teaching in the Theravada tradition. And each of the four foundations actually says that we should observe the arising and passing away. So let me see if I can, I don't know if I can pull that up that quickly on my Kindle, but that's it's understood that that impermanence is meant to be, you're meant to reflect on the impermanence of body, impermanence of feeling, impermanence of mind, and the impermanence of phenomena. So that's it's it isn't stated as impermanence, but it's in the section, I believe it's the section where it says insight. If you read the Satipatthana, I'm trying to find my Majjhima Nikaya. There it is, and I think I have a oh yeah, here I am actually on the Satipatthana. So let me go back. So here we are. This is about body. It says, in this way, one abides contemplating the body, his body internally, externally, or else one abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing. So the arising and vanishing is a reference to impermanence. So that's the implication of each of the Satipatthanas. Yeah.
Thanks.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. And you know, in the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the kind of companion sutta, there it is explicit. The Anapanasati Sutta has 16 steps in it. And the 13th step is impermanence, and then it goes to impermanence and fading away and cessation. So it's that whole the whole fourth foundation of mindfulness in this in the Anapanasati Sutta is focused on impermanence.
Right, because aren't the tetrads often correlated, like for the
Yes,
first, but yeah, so that would
the
track.
four te yes, the four tetrads correlate to the four foundations of mindfulness. Yeah, I'm writing a book on that actually. So
Well, I look forward to reading it.
I'm waiting to hear from Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano. They're both reading my manuscript to give me notes. So,
Nice.
yeah.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for that question. J Hello, John. John number two.
So I followed you on when you were talking about the three refuges, taking refuge in the Dhamma and the Sangha, but I didn't hear you or I wasn't listening, could be both, taking refuge in the Buddha and how you translated that, if you could offer that.
Yeah, so the way Ajahn Amaro, let me go back to that, talks about it is as the wakeful mind. Let's see. Being the Buddha is being awake. So the practice of in this way of developing the practice of meditation, the heart is embodying that quality of wakeful awareness, essentially it is being Buddha, being awake. So the word Buddha translates as awake. So so when people said, you know, who are you? He's just like, I'm awake, you know. And so, yeah, so the wakeful mind, the mind that is present. I mean, awake is a metaphor, right? I mean, so much of this language, it's not literal, right? I mean, we know, like in English, awake just means you're not asleep. But on the metaphorical level, I mean, if I'm not being too, you know, obvious here, but, you know, to waking up, you know, being enlightened, awakened. So it just means that you're being present and mindful is essentially the same thing as being awake, right? It's just more sort of secular language and less spiritual sounding, you know. But yeah, so it's like the wakeful mind sees the truth of the way things are, the Dharma, and what arises out of that is harmonious action and harmonious community.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Another John, but this one has an H in his name.
I actually didn't have anything to say. I just wanted to make it a John three-peat.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin. You're amazing.
Are you kidding? You were kidding?
Yeah, I was seriously. That's all I wanted to say.
You're killing me.
Sorry.
Jeez. Thank you, John.
Love you guys.
Any other thoughts or questions here that don't have to do with your name? Well, let's see. What can I tell you? I don't have anything else to say.
So Tuesday, you weren't sure if you were going to be teaching or not. Is that correct?
Next Tuesday. Yeah, so the tricky part about next Tuesday is I'm thinking I'm going to be staying in a hotel Monday night and then going to another hotel on Tuesday night. And so the trick is like, can I have late checkout or something? We'll have to see. I'm sorry, I can't make a promise.
Walt will be here. I looked on the schedule. Walt is signed up to teach.
Great.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
And John said, when will the retreat you're leading become available to sign up for? The retreat that I'm leading that starts tonight?
No, sorry. The one, the annual retreat that's... like down by Santa Cruz, I think.
Oh yeah. I don't know. That's like let me look and see when that is. I have actually 5 retreats scheduled for next year, which is more than I think I've ever done. So Redwood Glen is gonna be February 27th to March 3rd. That's a Tuesday to a Sunday. And, you know, sometime in the next couple months, it's tricky. But don't worry, you won't miss it. And then in May, Vimalasara and I are going to Big Bear, May 9th to the 13th. I don't know why it ends on a Monday, but maybe Paula knows. In June, I'm going to Louisiana near St. Louis or whatever, what's that city down there? New Orleans. And then in July, I'm going to Cincinnati of all places. So I'm getting around next year, but I'll get all that up on my website soon. All right, you guys. Nice to see everyone. I hope you can stay awake and see the way, the truth of the way things are, and bring about harmonious action. Blessings.
Thanks, Kevin.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Kevin.
All right, Mike. Nice to see you.
Yeah. See you later.
See everybody.